Are you ready to experience the rich interconnection of spirituality, orientation, and identity? If so, plan to attend Liberating Your Divine Identity, a retreat at Unity Village during Pride Month, June 9th to the 12th. This soul-filled retreat is facilitated by LGBTQIA+ Unity Ministers, with workshops and ceremonies to cultivate a deeper awareness of our spiritual nature. Register at unityvillage.org/IAmDivine2022.
You're listening to Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Welcome to World Spirituality, exploring the unity within all cultures and faith traditions, with your host, Reverend Paul John Roach.
So, hello and welcome to World Spirituality on the Unity Online Radio Network. Yes, I'm your host, Paul John Roach, coming to you once again from College Station. I'm with my grandson and his parents, and so it's lovely to be down here. And if you've never been to College Station, check it out sometime. It's wonderfully wooded and a delightful place to be. It's in that belt of Texas where there's lots of oak trees, whatnot. So a lovely place to be. I'd kind of dismissed it in the past because I've got lots of people who involved with Austin, Texas. But there's something about Aggieland that's very attractive. So today is part two in our series on unity and interfaith. Last week, we looked at the concept of interfaith in general and its history in terms of unity as well, and the latest initiatives that are happening at Unity Worldwide Ministries and the task team that's been established. Today, two other members of our task team, Reverend Kelly Isler and Reverend Jan Chase, join me to talk about interfaith, but especially in relation to compassion as an interfaith and multicultural necessity, and how interfaith interfaces with social action, justice, and sociological and political issues and concerns. So we got a lot to talk about in that case, haven't we? Both Kelly and Jan, like I say, are members of the Interfaith and Multicultural Task Team. In addition, Kelly is a Unity minister, holds several certifications in various models of human and organizational development. She served in the adjunct faculty of Unity Worldwide Spiritual Institute. She's also the chair of the Greater Kansas City Interfaith Council. She's a blogger and writer for Unity Magazine and other organs, and a self-confessed Christian sannyasa monk, activist, and leader in the global interfaith movement. And that's only the beginning. We could add so much more because Kelly is very, very active in many areas. Jan Chase has been the senior minister of Unity of Pomona since 2003, as Pomona in California. And before that, I had the honor of having her as my associate minister at Unity Church of Fort Worth for 3 years. She's deeply committed to interfaith and multiculturalism and has a long resume of activities in grassroots interfaith. And I know she's going to share some of that today. So it's a joy to welcome Jan and Kelly to today's show. Glad you're with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We also have a ministerial student who's sitting in, Brenda, and she's going to just observe. And you're welcome to say a few words if you feel so inspired, okay?
Thank you very
All right,
much.
So let's talk about compassion because, you know, one of the biggest things about interfaith for me is more love. You know, in the world, we need more love. We need more compassion. And compassion is important because it's an extension of love, isn't it? It's understanding the hurt in another, right? It's empathizing with. And it seems to me that interfaith at heart is about that, you know, understanding other people's pain, even if we don't agree with their theological viewpoint or we see differences, we all suffer, we all have the same hopes and desires, we all have the similar joys. So that seems to be crucial. So let's just throw that out as a talking point, the nature of compassion. What do you think?
Well, it's I'm going to jump right in because it's certainly, and then Jan, I'm sure, will continue to jump right in as well, because it is really a foundational piece of interfaith work, because it's moving from, you know, what we learn on our journey. And when you start being part of humanity and part of, you know, connecting with humanity and supporting healing what ills Earth and what ills, you know, humanity, is learning the difference between sympathy, empathy, and compassion. There are three different things. And compassion is, and you said empathy, and the empathy is, you know, identifying with the other and whatever the other's need is, and sharing that. And then compassion goes to the next step, where it's not only the identification with the other and whatever their need is, but then it's the involvement in the action to meet the need. So the compassion is, oftentimes we talk about compassion as though it's a feeling. And for me, it's really, it's not that. It's much more than that. It's like crossing a bridge, being in another person's world, being able to identify with their world, and supporting them in being in action to meet whatever their need is, to heal whatever the suffering is and the sorrow, and, you know, support individual or organizational or collective in, you know, returning to their sense of wholeness.
So it's not real compassion unless there's that action step. That
but for me,
To do something, right?
Yeah.
And of course, Jesus emphasized that. So did the Buddha, you know. Mm-hmm. There's feet on your love when it becomes compassion.
Right.
Oh, Jan, I know you've been involved with compassionate cities and other. Tell us about your involvement.
So I've been very involved with a number of local interfaith groups. In 2015, we went to the Parliament of the World's Religions in Salt Lake City. 26 of us went and presented a workshop about our compassionate work and our interfaith work together. And we grew into really a family of different networks all coming together. And at this parliament, we heard over and over again about this movement of compassionate cities and signing the Charter of Compassion that Karen Armstrong had created and the Dalai Lama works with. And so we came back determined to become a group of compassionate cities in our valley, in our area. And we met once a month. We brought in more and more people. We studied compassion. We studied Karen Armstrong's book, 12 Steps to a Compassionate Life. And we kind of embodied compassion. We began to take it on ourselves. And we worked with our mayor, with our city council, to get them to not just sign a piece of paper and say, well, yeah, we're a compassionate city, but to really do the work of working together grassroots with the city and with other groups, other nonprofits, different faith traditions, so that we could really embody that whole idea of compassion. And we became officially Compassionate Pomona on April 2nd, last year, 2018. And since then, our city sends, our city manager comes to most of our meetings, as well as another woman that is the outreach coordinator for the city. We have our superintendent of schools also was involved in signing the document, and we worked with him and with the school board. So it's like a whole lot of players are working on compassion, and we're bringing compassion into the schools. We're bringing compassion into our city council chambers, asking people to do compassionate listening and compassionate speaking instead of just hurtling hate at each other, which has been known to happen in city council meetings around hot issues. And so that was kind of the beginning. And since then, it just grows and grows, and more people are involved, and compassion is really spreading. Now it's a word. Before, it was a word nobody really worked with at the city level, and now our mayor is just pronouncing us. We are a compassionate city, and other cities around us are looking at how can we be compassionate too.
That's pretty cool, isn't it? Is there any link between that and sanctuary cities? I mean, is there any work being done in tandem, or are they separate right
it's
now?
It's not the same as sanctuary yeah. cities. And that's the, I mean, a city, a compassionate city may decide to become a sanctuary city.
Right.
But some cities resist becoming a compassionate city because they think it means sanctuary. And really, a compassionate city is a city that decides what their issues are and how they want to deal with them compassionately. There's no specific way to do that. It's the group working together to make those decisions.
What I like about it, too, is that, you know, so often we work on policies or changing the actualities within our cities, right? And that's when it gets kind of difficult if you've got these hot issues. But when you're talking about compassion, I think in essence, everybody wants to be compassionate. You know, everybody that has some kind of a faith base to their lives, you know, can see that the golden rule and loving each other is important. So it's not a stretch. And so it influences policies because you shift the attitude towards something and then you look at the need for policy change differently, right? Rather than you might resist it if you're coming with the old style. So it's a new approach that I think is very effective, and also it's bringing spirituality or unity, if you like, in our case, into the street, isn't it? It's making it very practical, making it very relevant, right? Because sometimes we tend to be, you know, the best kept secret in town, and we keep ourselves to ourselves because we think we're special and everything. And this is great because it's like spreading it into the everyday world. We're noting unity everywhere we go rather than keep it as something special for ourselves.
And it's like street.
To me, that's interfaith.
It's like street religion.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
It is.
Karen Armstrong, the founder of the Charter for Compassion, says that a compassionate city is an uncomfortable city. Because a city that's uncomfortable when anyone is homeless or hungry, that discomfort is what drives the city to create the opportunities for people to grow and thrive so that, you know, child knows it's loved, you know, there's education, there's food, you know. So when a city, a community is uncomfortable, then they, you know, step up to, you know, to treat each other with respect. To socialize together in communities that are more diverse than maybe people had been used to in the past. So it's really the discomfort, you know, it's the giant paradox. For me, every spiritual truth is a paradox. So we think compassion, but in the same breath, in order for a city to be compassionate, it has to be uncomfortable, because it's to be uncomfortable means we're willing to take a look at where we're missing the mark. And not caring for each other and not making sure that people's needs are met and have enough to eat and a roof over their head and have all the opportunities to live a life that's thriving and good and, you know, earth is valued and people are valued and all faiths are valued and no faiths and all of it. So I always have loved that line, that a compassionate city is an uncomfortable city.
Yeah, and I agree completely, because one of the greatest, you know, difficulties on the spiritual path in general and in life is the sense of complacency, right?
Yep.
That we've got it all together. We make the, you know, rules and movement takes place, you know, behind the scenes at the country club or, mm-hmm. you know, wherever, instead of, you know, involving a larger amount of people. And then we tell the people what we've discussed in our behind the scenes, you know, and that's the opposite. It's a very complacent approach, and we're sort of a paternalistic almost. We'll take care of it for you, you know.
Yeah, and it actually becomes very disconnecting.
Yeah, exactly. So it shakes it up, but again, you're appealing to people at a higher level. You're drawing forth their higher angels, aren't you? Their
yeah.
higher belief in them, in themselves, and in what they want for the community, rather than, you know, they're in their enclave and everybody else is in theirs, and, you know, that's fine. That's no longer good enough, right? We want the city to be lifted up for all citizens, not just for, you know, the people who have the power, so to speak. So,
yep.
Our mayor talks about people getting out of their silos and working together.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is one of the ways, and it's not that becoming a compassionate city made us compassionate, but it brings the awareness more forthright, because right. Pomona has always been a compassionate city. We have a lot of problems, and we've been known for a lot of problems. We've had a lot of homelessness, and we are the city that stepped up to build a shelter, which just opened about 6 months ago, and we have people moving through this shelter on their path to homes with wraparound services given to them. So it's like we're so proud of the compassion that we have and that we show. And cities around us that are much richer are looking at us to, like, how can we become compassionate too? So it's a very exciting time.
You know, I had a little breakthrough on Facebook recently, and it was some of my more conservative friends, you know, they put up something about the Democrats are spending so much time, you know, with the illegal immigrants, and they're ignoring our homeless, and we need to look after our homeless. And I just responded by saying, you know, I don't see the Republicans jumping on this issue either. You know? and they wrote back, well, that's not the point. But the end it said, you know, we just need to get along. Could you and I, you know, agree to come up higher? And I just wrote back, amen, you know, because it was like at least there was a sense of humanity there, right? There was a little breakthrough moment, you know, because it's easy to put things on other people, you know, they're the ones to blame, etc. But, you know, you've got to be honest, you know, the other side isn't doing anything, you know, quote, other side isn't doing, you know, anything anyway. So it's a larger problem than just choosing off sides. And unfortunately, you know, in our present culture, we're into divisive and dualistic thinking, aren't we? Polarizing is so strong right now. So, you know, work that befuddles that, you know, is important, you know, however it shows up. But, you know, compassion does shift the playing field there, I think, because it invites something larger than the usual, you know, the usual complacency or whatnot.
One of the things that we have done here in Pomona is I got a call from the president of our Chamber of Commerce one day last year, and he said, Jan, I have this idea, and I know you're going to love it. And I said, okay, David, what is it? And he said, well, there are these signs. They're welcome your neighbor signs. And what they say is, no matter where you are from, we're glad you're our neighbor. And they're yard signs that can also be put in windows, and they're in Spanish and Arabic. And I brought this to the group, and David came and brought it to the group. And then someone said, well, let's have other languages because we have so much diversity in our city. So we had our Vietnamese friends translated into Vietnamese, and then we had Mandarin put on and English on the other side. And so we have five languages. And so our city council donated money to buy these signs, and now we're distributing. We've had two printings of them so far. And it's just a beautiful thing around immigration, you know, and letting people know that, you know, we love our immigrants. So it's beautiful. That was our second accomplishment, was getting those signs printed.
And you're fired up about this, Jan, right? You're excited.
I'm so excited. We're also building a compassion quilt. One of our leaders is an artist, and he's designed a quilt with squares that have geometric shapes in them, all spiritually related, you know, the Star of David and circles and various things. And people, children in the school system, people in the homeless shelter, faith traditions, nonprofits, everybody is welcome to come and talk about compassion, how to receive compassion, how to have compassion for yourself, and how to give compassion. And as we paint this quilt, our Unity Church just had this last Friday, and it was like a meditation. It was so beautiful. We also have at our church, at our Unity Church, we host a group called Forward Progress that works with people that have just gotten out of prison. And they have a class on Mondays, and so yesterday they were working and painting on the compassion quilt. So people really love this, and then they're going to be gathered together and hung in City Hall and then be able to travel to various places. So very inspiring work.
You know, I'm a unity minister, as you all are too, and you know, we tend to be positive minded, don't we? Sometimes to a fault, and you know, but I do believe in the inherent goodness of people. You know, whenever there's a tragedy, there's always thousands of people that rally round to help. Whenever there's some kind of reverse in our society, there's always those people who do amazingly self-sacrificial things. You know, I was, of course, listening to a lot of the D-Day shows last week, you know, because it was the 75th anniversary of the landings in Normandy. And, you know, you listen to the stories of some of the soldiers, just ordinary folks, but doing extraordinary things, you know, doing you know, total loving and compassionate things in the midst of the horror, even though they, you know, might die, and many of them did. But that seems to be, you know, the best of human nature, right? And so these activities around compassion, drawing forth that. I know it's become a cliche, you know, when Michelle Obama said, when they go low, we go high. It's been sort of become almost a laughing stock or whatever. But it's so true, isn't it? There's the choice. You know, if somebody is, you know, insistent upon divisiveness, so the only way is not to fight that, but to go to the highest angels of our nature, as they say, you know, to countermand that, right? To remember the real, what's really going on. And when I see people, you know, rushing to help in terror situations, you know, it warms my heart, because I realize that that's who humanity truly is. That's the vast majority of people, I think.
And I think you don't, we don't stop to the beauty of that is because we don't stop to think whether we should or not, or can or not, or what do they believe, and should I step in and do this? It's just a function of being human that we just naturally, I believe, we are naturally created to take responsibility for each other. And the more challenging the situation, like, you know, people being gunned down in a mosque or a synagogue, or there's a, you know, a flooding or whatever, you know, in the bigger tragic things, we don't, thank God, we don't stop and say, oh, should I? I don't know. Is it, you know, in terms of, you know, if I can or not. And that's actually, for me, the heart of interfaith work is, but in a, without necessarily the disaster thing in there, but pausing to notice that there are, where it's finding the places where we agree and building on those without like overthinking it, but also recognizing where we don't agree, but not trying to change where we don't agree, and also not allowing those differences to keep us separated, but rather celebrating that diversity, because that's what the work is about. And when it's something big going on, we just have a tendency to, you know, we kind of downshift into our true nature, which is to take care of each other, to be responsible for each other. And interfaith work for me is intentionally finding unconscious blocks that keep us from taking responsibility for each other, taking responsibility for Earth, without having to change anyone's mind about what they believe or what they think. We always get stuck at the level of content, you know, what we believe. We get stuck at, you know, if you believe Jesus this way or you believe Jesus that way, there's this difference and never the twain shall meet. And so we can't get together on, you know, and do work together. And it's not about the content. It's about the values and the passion that are underneath the content that are the same. You know, for me, my passion for there's one presence and one power, and we are each created as that. My passion for that belief, for valuing that, is every bit as strong and deep as someone who's an evangelical Christian, that thinks differently, that believes differently, but we share the same passion. And so we find the places where we agree and build on it, and we celebrate the inherent diversity in our lives.
Beautifully put. Yeah, absolutely. And you make a good point. You know, it's crisis brings it out, but sometimes we're hampered when we're not in crisis. You think, oh, well, I don't know if I should do that, or
we overthink
we're complacent or whatever. We do know, right? So part of the interfaith movement, part of what we're talking about in compassion, is to inspire us in the ordinary times as well, you know, right. in our everyday lives, right? To break down that whatever it is that holds us back, the certain reticence, or sometimes, well, I won't make any difference if I do that. Well, that's so untrue, isn't it? Because it's the little things that often make a huge, huge difference. And I remember Don Cupid. He was a bishop of York or somewhere back in the 80s. He wrote a couple of books, but one of the things he said has always stuck with me, and I've probably quoted it a number of times on the radio over the years, but he said, we can differ in theory but agree in practice, mm-hmm. which is what you're saying, you know.
Right.
We're always going to disagree in theory because we have different theories, everybody's unique, but we still want to love each other, you know, and we'll look after our children, etc. There are commonalities in practice that bring us together, and that's where it begins, I think, is you know, again, compassion is an action word. It's putting it into practice, and that's huge. That makes all the difference. In the second part, folks, we're going to talk more about how we can do that and some of the things that we're doing in our task team, and of course leading up to the Unity Convention that's just happening next week, and we'll talk about that and some of the events that are happening for us next week. But right now we're going to take a break. I'm with Kelly Isla and Jan Chase. They're both Unity ministers and highly involved in interfaith. And it's a joy to have them on the show. If you want to find out more about Kelly, what's the best way to do that, Kelly?
Go to my website, kellyisola.com.
All right, that's easy, kellyisola.com. Yeah. What about you, Jan?
Well, we have our Unity of Pomona website, but we're in the middle of creating a new one, so it's not the best. But we also have a Compassionate Pomona brand new website. So you can go to
okay.
either of those and
good.
See some of the things that we're doing.
All right. Join us after the break.
You're listening to Unity Online Radio. Celebrating diversity and inclusivity for Pride Month. We are one.
As Unity Online Radio continues to expand its programming and outreach around the world, we depend on the generosity of listeners like you. If you enjoy the programming, please make your donation today by going to unityonlineradio.org and click on Donate. Thank you for your support.
Here's a Unity Wisdom Moment with Eric Butterworth.
How much time is enough time? You ever thought about that? How much time is enough time? Time is not a quantity. It cannot really be measured. Oh, you say, but it can. I have a watch. But the watch is synthetic. There's no way to really measure time because time is a depth. It's an allness. You may say, but I only have an hour. I only have a day. And so all you do is admit to yourself and to others that you've encased yourself in a shell. And this time frame will always frustrate your creative flow. And time for you will be a matter of the clock ticking on. But it's only where you are in consciousness. So it's time to slow down, to look up, to get a sense of the eternal. And this basically is the purpose of prayer.
To hear more talks from Eric Butterworth, visit truthunity.net.
Experts say picking up a pen and paper and writing things down can have some amazing benefits. Spark some creativity by sketching, doodling, and writing down what you want in life with a set of Unity Inspiration Notepads. They come in three inspirational designs with themes of gratitude, intention setting, and visualization. These are great tools to keep on your desk and use every day. Just $12.99 for a set of three. Pick up yours today at unityonline.org/shop.
Unity teaches that all people are created with sacred worth and that no one exists outside the heart of God. The Unity message is free from discrimination, and we believe that love is the strongest power that exists no matter who you choose to love. Always and especially during this month of Pride, Unity stands with our LGBTQ family as we honor the strength of diversity in our spiritual community. If you'd like more information, visit unity.org/LGBTQ.
Would you like to experience more peace and joy in your life through A Course in Miracles? Let Reverend Jennifer Hadley support you in discovering the powerful life lessons available through this unique spiritual thought system that teaches the way to love and peace is through forgiveness. Join Jennifer every Tuesday at 10 a.m. Central for A Course in Miracles, Living the Love, Walking the Talk, to experience the healing for yourself on Unity Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Call now with your question or comment. 816-251-3555. That's 816-251-3555.
We now return to World Spirituality with Reverend Paul John Roach.
All right, welcome back to today's show. I'm with Kelly Isler and Jan Chase, and we're talking about interfaith and unity. This is part two in our series, and I wanted to throw something out. Every time you turn on television, you see endorsements of political parties by evangelicals and other religious leaders, and some people in unity say, hey, how come we don't put something up like that? And of course, there is such a thing as the separation of church and state, supposedly, in our Constitution. But many of our evangelical brothers and sisters don't seem to heed that one. They're happy to be political. So, you know, and this has been a bit of a topic in unity of late. You know, how do we get active? How do we get out there without being political? But at the same time, you know, not just whitewashing everything and not getting involved in hot button issues. There's a lot out there right now. And when I say out there, here in us, around us, not just, you know, separate from us. So what you thinking on that? Can unity be political, or would that be a real mistake?
Well, I think it already is. But what I've discovered in all these conversations is that it depends how you define political. I think when I say I think it already is, what I mean by that is that we have the capacity, I think, and the responsibility to address issues that go on in people's lives through the lens of our faith. So people struggle with the idea of refugees. People struggle with the idea of Islamophobia. They just struggle with the idea of, you know, even religions that, you know, are maybe religious ideas that are seemingly in direct conflict with what you believe. And the irony of interfaith work is that the more you be in dialogue with other people and the more you learn about the differences and be able to, you know, faith or philosophical differences, the more you be involved in that and learn how to be with that, believe it or not, you actually expand your capacity for understanding your own faith and going deeper with your own spiritual practices and your own beliefs and your own, you know, the foundation on which you stand. So when I say that I think unity already is political, what I mean by that is that I have a lens through which I look through the world, and a lens that I'm looking through when I'm doing a Sunday talk or I'm teaching a class. I don't talk about particular people or politicians, but politics itself is about the issues that go on in my day-to-day life that surround me. You know, like I said, refugees, LGBTQ, racism, classism, ageism. Pick something that's about the human condition. And I think we have a responsibility to have a response to that, whatever that response may be. But to not be talking about it, I think, is just avoiding life, frankly.
Right. I like what you're saying. And it doesn't have to be partisan, right?
Right.
There's a higher view of polity or the political spectrum that's in our world that involves us all. What do you think, Jan? You'd agree with that?
Well, I agree. I think it's a challenge. I have people of all different political perspectives in my congregation, and so I tend to not talk about politics, but I do tend to talk about action. And I, as kind of you were Kelly was talking about before, of stepping out in action in ways that work with, for you and with you and with your belief system, but also inviting people to do action. And that's why this compassion is so powerful. And learning how to be in community and have different beliefs or different opinions. Of course, everybody in Unity tends to have different belief systems, different experiences anyway, because we go direct to God. So I just think that if I continue to ask people to tune into headquarters and get their what is theirs to do now information and step out and do it, then that's a way to get people involved and active. But I would like to see Unity's name on some of the efforts that we mostly agree on.
Right.
And some of those were ones that Kelly mentioned. Yeah.
Yeah, like right. You know, right now it's Pride Month, and so, you know, I know a church that I've been serving part-time in South Carolina, and other churches too, you know, we made sure we had a table in literature at the Pride Fest parade. Because it's not that necessarily there's something written somewhere by our co-founders, Charles or Myrtle, about specifically, you know, LGBTQ issues, as much as it is about that we are, our teachings are there, you know, as Charles called it, a living religion. So our teachings, our principles that we can adopt and practice for living a meaningful, abundant life, and to know that your life is sacred and just as worthwhile as anybody else's and just as worthwhile as Earth, you know. And so that's, you know, having a table at a Pride Fest is less about, you know, being against something and more about this is who we are.
Right, absolutely.
Been very involved in the Poor People's Campaign,
right,
with the NAACP and standing up for a lot of those ideas of against racism, which is very prevalent now institutionally, and looking at how we can make a change in our community. So there's a lot of ways to get involved politically. Yeah.
And, you know, we're talking about Pride Month. You know, we've already seen a little backlash to that, right? People want straight month or whatever. And, you know, rather than resist that, it seems, you know, to embrace it and say, you know, have a laugh with it and move on. Because there's always going to be those forces that want to, you know, like with Black Lives Matter, we had White Lives, all Lives Matter or whatever. And, you know, that to me, that's not the point. You know, of course, all lives matter, but we're trying to say something about, you know, disadvantages here. And, you know, so, but I rather than resist it, because that's my initial, you know, response is, oh, my goodness, is to just laugh about it. And, you know, if that's the way they want to go, usually things that are, you know, given a little space, they disappear after a while because there's no real foundation to them. You know, we can get back to what's really important. And in terms of that, I'm honored to have Reverend Karen Bradley on my show next week. And she happens to have a gay orientation, and she'll be talking about her life in ministry. She's retired now. Fascinating person, wonderful person. So tune into that show next week as part of Pride Month. And it's certainly, we talked about a lot more about things than just that, because we don't want to just be you know, only focused on that, because, you know, Karen is a wonderful person on all kinds of levels. So that's important to acknowledge, too. So we are putting on a workshop and a service next week, right, for interfaith. Mm-hmm. And we're hoping that, you know, we're going to teach something about what interfaith is in that workshop, and then have a good celebration during the service, and that'll be at the convention next week in Overland Park, Kansas. So if you're in that area or you're planning to come to a convention, come along to the workshop and the service on Wednesday night. It'll be fun. I'm not sure when the workshop is. Do we know that yet?
It's Tuesday afternoon, 1:30 to 3:00.
1:30 to 3:00, Tuesday afternoon, first full day of convention. And then in line with that, I know, Kelly, you wanted to talk about the nuts and bolts of interfaith. You've been involved with the Greater Kansas City Interfaith. In fact, you serve, as we said, as the chair of that.
Mm-hmm.
So give us a little rundown of how we might approach it if we're interested in getting more involved.
So if someone was, had not previously been involved with interfaith work, one of the first places to start is to just check out within your own town or nearby town what interfaith organizations exist. And some places they don't, and some places maybe only have an intrafaith. An intrafaith would be something like, multiple different Christian religions come together, because there are some big differences, say, between, Lutheran and evangelical Baptist or African Episcopalian and Catholic. There's a Christian root, but how those are expressed can be very different. So even if all you had locally was an intrafaith organization, attending that, there are numerous online videos or webinars. So go online and look at the Parliament of the World's Religions to start educating yourself, or United Religions Initiative is another place to start connecting yourself. That's the first place for anybody is to just start with connecting and finding others that have some interest in interfaith, that have some interest in learning about other religions and learning about, the differences, or even what the heck does interfaith mean. I was, about a month and a half ago, was doing a 3-day workshop at a local university here and discovered that half of the room of these college kids, there was me and a couple other presenters, and we started the conversation, we're doing some work, and about 10 minutes in, we realized that half of the room didn't even know what the word interfaith meant. And so we're like, oh, I guess we need to backpedal. So for me, the beginning place is just to learn what interfaith is, find out what, if any, organizations are within your community. If there aren't any, then there are multiple interfaith councils and organizations you can Google, for any city. But here in Kansas City, our monthly council meetings we have a Zoom count, so our Zoom is always up, so anybody could actually join from anywhere in the world if they wanted to just be a part of the council meeting. That's a starting place for me, is to just get yourself connected and get yourself educated. Because it's the longer you're in it, the more you learn and the less you realize you know.
Yeah, which is always a good thing.
Yep. Yeah. Keep you humble.
And, always be willing to be surprised. I did a blessing for a wedding the other day. And it was for a college professor that I know quite well, who's studies East Asian religions and has been a practitioner of various Buddhist and Hindu disciplines for many years. He married an Indian woman who's a research scientist, but she's a Christian and grew up in the Church of South India. So, we have this expectation, you see a Hindu person in the sari or whatever, must be a Hindu and follow that religion, but not necessarily. There's a large amount of Christians in India, for instance, as there are a large amount of Muslims in India as well. Right. So, this is wonderful for me, because it's like we have these stereotypes that people are supposed to look a certain way.
Right.
And it doesn't always work out that way, right? It's like you said, find out what you don't know, and be amazed, because I love that. I always want to stay teachable for as long as I live, right? I don't want to know everything.
Right.
It seems like we're redundant then, if we know have everything sorted out, then we may as well not be here anymore. It's good to stay open, full of joy and wonder, and that's part of my belief system, and I know you both share that.
Well, even the using the example of a woman in a sari, and we think that she practice a Hindu faith, and what people don't realize is that there's Hindu culture and then there's a Hindu religion, and just because someone's in a sari doesn't mean Hindu religion.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. Jan, I know, I know you wanted to jump in here. Go ahead.
Well, a couple things. One is, one of my interfaith groups, the Upland Interfaith Council, has every month, it conversations about God. We meet in the public library, and we invite people of different faiths to share about their faith tradition. And they can do it multiple times, or so you get to go into depth and learn, as you're talking about, learn and learn and learn, and find the commonalities and find the differences. And so it is all good. So that's one way that interfaith group can work. Another way is one of my interfaith groups that it works towards Middle East peace. We have an interfaith walk every year. We've done it for 10 years now, and we walk usually between a mosque, a Sunni mosque, a Shia school, and a church. We use different churches each year, and the Temple Beth Israel, our Jewish friends. We have done this so long that now every year it's like a family reunion. People just are so in love with each other. So it's very common to see, Christians in the mosque and Jews in the Christian church and hijabs in the Jewish synagogue. So this year we had our compassionate group had our second conference, and it was called Pomona Reawakening, and it was in February. And we invited Azim Kamisa and our mayor, Tim Sandoval, to be keynote speakers. Azim had spoken at our conference the previous year, and you talk about coming out of tragedy. He is a man that is a Sufi Muslim whose 20-year-old son was killed while delivering pizzas for a weekend job while he was in college by a 14-year-old gang member. And Azim, being a meditator, had an out-of-body experience when he got the news of his son's death and realized in that instant that he lost consciousness that there were victims on both ends of the gun. And when he awoke, he realized it was the 14-year-old gang member was not to blame, but it was the community, society, and that he had to do something to stop kids from killing kids, and he created a foundation. And out of this foundation then, and he's written a number of books that are fantastic. He speaks actually at a lot of Unity churches. He's very aligned with our belief system. And as he looked out over the crowd of about 300 people at the Jewish temple, he had this realization that there's such diversity in cultures, in faiths, in ages, that he told us this could be, Pomona could become one of the first restorative practice cities in the United States. Now, I'd never heard of a restorative practice. I've heard of restorative justice, but not restorative practice. And so we began to explore that, and one of our members took a leadership position on this, and now he's brought Azim back three times at least, to talk with our mayor, to talk with our superintendent of schools, to talk with our the head of our mental health institute, so that we are and our police chief. So we are looking at how do we, is this something we want? How do we get training to become a restorative practice city, which means having the tools to learn how to heal relationships before we need, before harm is done. And then once harm is done, then you need restorative justice. But it's about bringing people together and learning how to work together when there's breaks in communication, there's breaks in relationships, how to heal that. And involving the community in circles to help people become accountable for their actions. So it's very exciting because we're seeing this more and more in our school system. The chief of police is going to training, as is our city manager, as is the head of our mental health institute. She sees this as a public health activity. And so, and then a number of us in our leadership positions in this grassroots movement of Compassionate Cities are also going. So it's like lifting the consciousness of ourselves and our whole community in the.
Very fascinating.
I think we lost her.
Yeah, Jan got so excited she just entered another level and disappeared from from our purview right now, but she'll be back. but fascinating stuff, because it's exciting, because we do live in silos. You know, we have our church, we have the city hall, we have, you know, this, that, and the other, and we keep them separate often.
Well, and there's a reason Martin Luther King said the most segregated hour of the week is Sunday morning.
Sunday morning, and it still is, in the certainly in the South. I can attest to that living in Fort Worth. But, you know, we have to get out of our silos, right, and into this cooperative awareness. And I love the idea of restorative anything, you know, because that the key word there, restorative, means that we once had it and we're now restoring it.
Right.
So it's exactly. Not like it's a whole new thing. This is getting back to a certain compassionate way of approach that's natural to human beings to work together.
Returning us to our inherent goodness.
Yes, there we go.
And our inherent
and that's
oneness.
Beautiful too.
Yeah.
One of the terms that I use in when I'm doing interfaith, you know, dialogue or interfaith work, or is, you know, and when you talk about, you know, we talk about the golden rule and, you know, do unto others as you would like to have done unto you, and I ramp it up to the platinum rule, which is do unto others as they would like to have done unto them, because it requires me to take that extra step to move from some empathy to compassion. Which means I have to find out how you would like to have done unto you, which requires conversation. It requires being present. It requires finding what's different about us. But the term that I use is, you know, when you love your neighbors is the same as your love for your own faith.
Mm-hmm.
And to kind of hold that as a container. That you kind of know.
I'm trying to go one better now, like a diamond rule. No rules, just smiles or something like that.
Well, I just do the platinum one because it requires me to go a step further in being in my discomfort. You know, like the compassionate city is an uncomfortable city. So to do unto others as they would like to have done unto them, I need to know you.
Right.
You know, it's just, you know, absolutely. Like, you know, how the Sikhs always, you know, a langar meal, you know, they serve it and it's rude not to take the food, and they don't want you to reciprocate with anything. They don't want you to get up and start clearing dishes. You know, that's doing unto them as they would like to have done unto them. So it just requires me to know a little bit more and to find out, I didn't know that.
Yeah, we talked about that last week, the Sikhs' generosity, and like you said, you know, creating these wonderful vegetarian feasts for people, and they love to do that. And it's just a great example of compassion in action, right?
Right.
I watched the whole TV series, I think it was from Britain, about a gurdwara, a temple, a Sikh temple in Scotland, and it showed them preparing these meals, and you know, people gave up lots of their time and volunteered their time to do this, and it was so important to them. They didn't mind, you know, they didn't mind the sacrifice of it, because it was such an ennobling experience for them. And you feel that when you partake of that kind of sacred meal, right? It's a wonderful thing, but they do it very naturally and organically. It's not sort of, I've got to feel the vibes here. It's not about that. It's just about doing what they consider to be the right and generous thing, and it blesses everyone.
Yeah,
wonderful stuff. We're almost at the end of the show. What else do we need to cover? What did we miss out? Because we've just got a couple of minutes to share with folks.
Well,
just a reminder, come to convention next week. Enjoy what the offerings we have.
Yeah, the workshop is about, you know, uncommon friends was sort of our theme, and how we create compassionate, respectful, and meaningful relationships and connections with people that are most unlike ourselves. Right, to see the other side, to defend another people, not despite their tradition, but because of it, is really the heart of our work. So the workshop has some very specific takeaways and learning and very experiential. And then Wednesday night from 7 to 8:30, Wednesday the 19th, we have an interfaith service that is using the theme, Unity's theme for the year, One Humanity, Many Stories, and doing the storytelling through meditation, through chanting, through dance, through the Hindus are going to do a puppet show and tell a story through puppets, a Hindu tradition. And through singing and the silence and dialogue. And so, again, very experiential, but all the different ways that while we're one humanity, we have many stories and there are many onenesses. You know, there's not just one definition of oneness. So,
right.
And that's open to the public, the 7 to 8:30 on Wednesday night.
Yeah, lovely.
And you put a lot of work into that, Kelly. I appreciate all that you and the
absolutely.
Council
yeah,
have
it's,
done.
It's fun.
Yeah. Wonderful.
Yeah, and the whole task team has done a lot of good work in the last year or so, thanks to Victoria Etchemindi, who's the chair of that particular team. And we're excited and fired up about the work that's being done and want to share that. And I hope you've been inspired these last couple of weeks with our various diverse approaches to interfaith and the things we've shared. And I hope it inspires you to go do something in your community. Let me tell you about next week's show. I've already mentioned it a little bit, and then we'll say goodbye to Jan and Kelly. Next week, Unity Minister Reverend Karen Bradley, as I mentioned, joins me for an occasional series when I focus on the life, the background, the passions, and the insights of a Unity minister. So find out more about Karen next week. But right now, I want to thank profusely Jan and Kelly for being with me and sharing so eloquently and with compassion, because that's what I feel is coming from you both, and the joy of doing this work. So thank you very much for being on today's show.
You're very welcome.
Thank you so much, Paul.
You're welcome.
Great
thank you,
Paul.
Folks, for tuning into this and other shows on Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world. Talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Are you ready to experience the rich interconnection of spirituality, orientation, and identity? If so, plan to attend Liberating Your Divine Identity, a retreat at Unity Village during Pride Month, June 9th to the 12th. This soul-filled retreat is facilitated by LGBTQIA+ Unity ministers, with workshops and ceremonies to cultivate a deeper awareness of our spiritual nature. Register at unityvillage.org/IAmDivine2022.